you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to be with you this morning after yesterday's surprise non-hostile takeover of the final segments of our program to celebrate the 39th anniversary, in case you missed it. Our producers, completely unbeknownst to me, lined up a series of guests and invited listeners to talk about our 39 years on the air. And so people I've known for many, many years, as well as listeners I've never met, took part in that. And I was so moved. It took me hours to come back down to earth. Thanks to everyone who took part in that. I read all of the wonderful listener comments that came in that we couldn't get on air, but I read every single one of them. They were so meaningful to me and to our team as well, our producers who put so much into this program every day. So thank you very much. We're going to lead off with a look at the proxy battle over Disney's board of directors. Billionaire Nelson Peltz and other candidates are looking for their place on the board of directors. The question is, by the deadline of 9 o'clock tonight Pacific time, what will the board of Disney look like? And what will that mean for the future of the company? Joining us, Los Angeles Times senior entertainment industry writer Meg James. Meg, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So let's just talk about who the players are. First of all, who is Norman Peltz?
Nelson Peltz.
Nelson Peltz
is a billionaire. He's had a very strong record of getting involved in companies. He in the 1990s, he bought Snapple from Quaker Oats, and he was able to turn a $300 million investment into more than $1 billion sale to later to Cadbury Schweppes. So he's served on DuPont. He's served on Procter & Gamble. He's the chairman of Wendy's Corp, the fast food chain. So he is a very successful activist shareholder, someone who gets involved in the companies that he invests in.
We've also got a smaller group, Blackwell's Capital, and what interest do they represent?
Well, they have a smaller stake in Disney, and frankly, in all respect to Blackwell's, their candidates haven't really made much of a splash with the big institutional investors. But they also saw that there's been problems that Disney has suffered from in the last couple of years. And so they, too, wanted to take a more activist role. However, in recent weeks, they've mostly been beating up on Nelson Peltz, sort of helping Disney out in their effort to change Disney's board.
And what is it Peltz wants to accomplish? What is his critique of Bob Iger's leadership of the company?
Well, this is a really interesting thing, and this is what I sort of focused on in the story today. While Nelson Peltz hasn't directly taken on Bob Iger, they have really challenged his leadership and some of the decisions that have been made. One of his critiques is that Disney erred when it bought much of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox, the film studio, the television studio, channels like FX. That acquisition, you know, cost Disney, it was a $71 billion acquisition, although by the time some of the pieces were sold off, it wasn't that much. But it left Disney in a tremendous amount of debt just, you know, a year before the pandemic hit, which obviously no one really knew how devastating that was going to be. And for Disney, the COVID pandemic shutdowns really clocked their businesses. You know, Disneyland was shut for a year. The movie studios, you know, the films, you know, could not open in theaters. So it was really quite devastating for Disney, more so than some of its competitors like Netflix.
All right. But do we know specifically, as Peltz said, going forward, here's what I would change in the types of priorities or the ways that Disney has its assets structured?
He has, and this is his second bid to join Disney's board. A year ago, he sort of folded his tents and went away after Bob Iger made some very sweeping announcements for changes he was going to make to the company. and Peltz thought that that was sufficient. He has in the past talked about, you know, maybe selling off some assets like ESPN or ABC, but his critique has been mostly that they need to increase profits to have more Netflix-like profits, but Disney is a fundamentally different company than Netflix, so that such things are hard. He also and the other investors have really zeroed in on Disney's struggles with Succession, how Bob Iger had to come back to save the company after a 2.5-year run by the handpicked successor, Bob Chapek. There's been a lot of scrutiny on, you know, why Disney has struggled so much to find a successor to Bob Iger. I quoted somebody in my story today saying, you know, Bob Iger isn't the only person to be able to run this company, but for many years, it seems like he is.
The huge fund CalPERS, which represents so many California public employees, and I should just disclose, I am a CalPERS pension recipient, that CalPERS is backing Peltz's efforts to get himself and another person with whom he's aligned onto the board. So what is this, just that they prefer his vision? Have they said what the reasons are that they're supporting Peltz instead of the company's candidates for the board?
Yes, CalPERS said specifically that they felt that this board could use a fresh pair of eyes, that the contention by some of the institutional advisors is that the board has been too aligned with the CEO. So therefore, you don't allegedly have the checks and balances that some investors feel should be there. Again, they point to the struggles with the succession. And also Disney's stock up until very recently was really underperforming. Again, a lot of problems, you know, that Disney had to grapple with during the pandemic, but their movie slate has also not fared as well as it had, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. So CalPERS said specifically that they felt the Disney board needed a fresh set of eyes.
We're talking with Meg James, Los Angeles Times senior entertainment industry writer, and we're talking about this proxy battle for seats on Disney's board and what it means for the future of the multi-layered entertainment company. Also with us, Sean McNulty, who covers Hollywood and media industry for his daily newsletter, The Wake Up, which is found at The Ankler. Sean, good to have you with us again. What are the stakes here for people who watch Disney content, who visit Disneyland or Disney World? What are the potential or watch ESPN? What are the potential effects on them?
Yeah, you said it right there at the end. The ESPN is probably the largest part of it. Peltz has been vocal. It's been part of one of his many bullet points about things he believes is not being done correctly. And ESPN is targeted to go direct to consumer next year in 2025. And that's really the big thing that Iger's, you know, working on right now. He also has big looming NBA deal renewals, which is happening right now in an exclusive window. The UFC is up for renewal. So sports is a big factor here. So from a consumer point of view, if Nelson is indeed, you know, in the mix here in the next year and gets on the board, you know, he's going to be very vocal about all these things, which, you know, could stir some strategy changes for Iger, whether that be through public pressure or whatnot. But that probably the place I look for in terms of where the public might see this manifest most.
So Disney announced, of course, their partnership with Warner Discovery and Fox in a direct-to-consumer streaming app that would provide all the sports that those companies provide. And you've also got Iger saying that ESPN is also going to have, even beyond its current ESPN Plus, a direct-to-consumer subscribable app, which includes the current cable and satellite-only ESPN channels. So is it likely, Sean, that if Peltz gets on the board, that those would be revisited or maybe canceled?
I guarantee he'll be putting out public statements on all of that, Larry. I think, you mentioned the we call Sports Hulu, the kind of upcoming bundle, which is slated to launch. You know, they've said, you know, essentially late August, early September. So the clock is ticking on that. That doesn't have a name, doesn't have a price. They did select a leader for it recently, but that timeline is moving fast. And I'm sure when the price gets announced, that's going to be something Nelson's going to have a comment on. You know, that's the thing here, Larry. Whatever news happens around Disney, you're going to have another public voice in the mix, which can be a distraction. You know, we saw this with the whole, you know, the Florida debacle that went on for a long time. And these things, Disney has some real problems and things that Iger needs to fix. And if this is on his list of things he has to deal with, in addition to the fixing the business fundamentals, you know, it could be detrimental to the company to a degree. So, but rest assured, Nelson will have some thoughts on all the things with sports going forward, I'm sure.
Well, and Sean, I think the question that many have is, you know, in Peltz's case, he's really looking out for the shareholder value, but Iger has to, as the CEO or whoever the CEO, has to balance out what this, because it's not just any media company, it's Disney company. There's a whole brand and image that one is responsible for as well, because it is part of what your consumer base is buying into. It's not just about pleasing investors, even though obviously it's a huge publicly traded company. So, Sean, how does Iger balance that out, even as he's getting, you know, the shots across the bow from Peltz?
You're exactly right. It's, you know, I mean, anything Disney steps into becomes a headline across the board, whether that's, you know, they want it to or not. So, you know, and maybe it's the succession factors, as Meg alluded to as well, is also big on there. That may be the thing that if he can get that set in an early, you know, maybe within, again, in this next year, that may reassure a lot of people, because that's the real big question here in the end, because it got, you know, frankly botched during the last attempt. So if he can maybe set that, that provides some reassurance, not only for those shareholders and investors, as you mentioned, Larry, but also those fans. They paid attention when Bob Chapek was, you know, selected, and he was the new face of Disney. They all knew him. He was at D23 and, you know, rah-rahing and cheering up the fans and things like that. So you're right. This, you know, it's an odd company that has a very public-facing CEO who has a relationship with its audience and its fans. So that may be the one key that he can, if he can nail in an earlier fashion this time and find that person that really satisfies both the fans and the shareholders, that may help to help land the plane here, so to speak.
We're talking with Sean McNulty, who writes the daily newsletter, The Wake Up, available at The Ankler, and Meg James, LA Times, senior entertainment industry writer. Meg, you know, I always thought that Disney's advantage is that it's got all these different arms of the company. It's got theme parks, so if they hit a stretch of dud movies, well, they've always got the theme parks. If there's something that cuts down on live admissions and the parks aren't doing as well, well, then you have the opportunity with television or film or sporting events, you know, to, but it's fascinating that, you know, Peltz, who's trying to get this seat on the board along with a second seat for an ally, that, you know, his thing is, well, why can't you be like Netflix, which really has just one job? Disney's trying to serve multiple masters here.
Well, that, you're making a point that Disney would make, that Disney's, the company is far more complex, and it has so many touch points for fans, for, as Sean has pointed out, sports fans, for people who watch, you know, Channel 7 local news. So it's a company that is so woven into our culture. It's different than other companies. And so that's what Disney would say. One of the things that's also been interesting is that Nelson Peltz's campaign has largely been fueled by the shares held by Ike Perlmutter, the former and longtime chairman of Marvel Entertainment, who was ousted by Iger a year ago among the layoffs that Disney had. So you have this sort of bad blood simmering just under the surface. And that's also what Disney's worried about, that you will get Nelson Peltz and his ally, Jay Rasulo, a former Disney executive, on the board, and that they will be carrying water for Ike Perlmutter, who's had this very long and contentious history with Iger. So, I mean, there's a lot of elements here that are at play. Yeah. And also, we just don't know how strong Disney's showing will be. There's a lot of thought that Disney will prevail, but still, you know, they could come away wounded from this proxy battle.
We have 11 and a half hours, I guess, till the polls close, so to speak, to find out where the voting comes down on the future of Disney's board. And we'll see what comes from this. As you're talking about Perlmutter and the bad blood, Meg, it just reminds me, and Sean too, about, I know it's an oversimplification, but in Hollywood, it just seems so much more personal than many other business sectors. ways that relationships get frayed and vendettas are issued, and so much of this becomes highly personal. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Meg James, LA Times senior entertainment industry writer, and Sean McNulty, who covers Hollywood and the media business for The Wake Up, his daily newsletter at The Ankler. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll be talking about LED headlights, which are very popular on many vehicles, enabling drivers to see much more clearly farther down the road, but often at the cost of oncoming drivers who can have temporary blindness from those bright lights. We'll talk about how they're tested and how it's decided that LEDs of a particular type are safe to be installed on vehicles. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Recently in the Wall Street Journal, the piece, America's Drivers Agree LED Headlights Are Just Too Bright, looked at the particularly white light that is emitted by LEDs. We see them on so many new cars now, and that's left often drivers who are coming the opposite direction from those LEDs complaining that it temporarily blinds them. They're so bright that they can't see. For many drivers who have LED headlights, they often like the fact that it seems to provide superior illumination, particularly if you're driving on some of the darker roads we're seeing in Southern California, because the street lights are out because of copper wire theft, which has left many of the lights on our local freeways and surface streets not functional anymore. So we're going to take a look at what's happening with these LED headlights, how they're tested. Are they, in fact, brighter than earlier headlights, or is it just the different type of light that can make it difficult for people to see who are in oncoming traffic? Joining us is David Ayler, who's Vice President of Active Safety at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. He oversees their headlight testing program. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So these LED headlights, we know they're more energy efficient, and they seem to illuminate more effectively than the older halogen headlights. But are they actually putting out a greater degree, a greater amount of light?
Say, I think a lot of it comes down to the color of the light, which makes them, you know, more noticeable. Headlights are required by the federal law to meet certain standards for the amount of light they output. And so I think, you know, the look of them is very different, which causes a problem, as well as, you know, some other problems we have, for instance, them, you know, being mounted on higher on SUVs and other large vehicles, which we have a lot of in our market.
Yeah, and I have to say for myself, that's the only time I really find it to be annoying is on the higher profile vehicles. If it's on a typical sedan, I don't find the LEDs to be much of a problem. But you know, so many of the vehicles that are on the roads these days are higher profile. So often those higher mounted LEDs are right in a sedan driver's line of sight.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one of the challenges we've found with our testing is it's not necessarily the type of light, but it's where the lights are pointed, where they're aimed. And even though there are requirements for how much light they put out, the vehicles aren't tested by the federal government on the vehicle themselves. And so it may be a great light, but if they're, you know, pointed too high, they're going to glare you know, drivers. If they're pointed too low, they're not going to provide enough visibility for the driver themselves. And so one of the things we do with our test is, you know, we actually test them on vehicles that we get from dealers, which takes into account how they're aimed.
And do then the manufacturers take your results into account and perhaps make a shift? Or, you know, when I would think if you've got a higher profile vehicle, a large SUV, for example, maybe there's not a lot of leeway on where the headlights can be installed. But is there something they could do in terms of the color of the light to make it a little yellower as opposed to so much white light, or decrease the intensity? What can they do if your testing finds that they can be a safety hazard to oncoming drivers?
Yeah, so, you know, there are some things they can do, but you're exactly right. With the height of the vehicles, it's sort of just geometry. It's very hard to illuminate further down the road without glaring drivers. But we have seen many manufacturers just make changes to the aim so that they can, you know, still get enough visibility in our test, you know, without producing glare for oncoming drivers. And so even, you know, small differences in how the manufacturer adjusts the aim can really make a big impact on how much glare it's producing for other drivers.
In the first generation LED lights available for home use, they had a lot of blue light, so it you know, created this very white light that's kind of tough on the eyes. Now, though, with newer generation LEDs, you can even adjust it. I have a desk lamp. I can put it to where there's a lot of blue light, so it's ultra white, or I can bring it down to mimic what an incandescent bulb used to look like with that much more yellowish kind of warmer lighting. Is that something that can be done with headlight LEDs?
Yeah, it's possible. We're not seeing it, but, you know, potentially they could change, you know, the intensity or at least the color of the light. You know, I will say, when we talk about headlight technology, you know, there's some other advantages that we're starting to see on vehicles. One is high beam assist, which is a technology that automatically switches between your low beams and your high beams based on the presence of other vehicles. And so, number one, we know drivers don't use their high beams enough. And so when there aren't cars around, they should use their high beams, but obviously switch them off when there are, you know, other drivers around. The other technology that just recently was approved in the U.S. is adaptive driving beam. And so by using LEDs, by having, you know, a matrix of LEDs, these systems can actually turn on and off the LEDs, you know, at the location of the other vehicles to really prevent glare. And so, there are some other technologies out there that, you know, we're starting to see or hope to see soon to really help increase visibility, but, you know, really reduce the glare as well.
We're seeing this with streetlights as well, where a number of cities, you know, to be more energy efficient, installed first generation LEDs and with much whiter light, and people complained about it so much. Now cities are looking at putting in LEDs, which have a much warmer tone, to try and adjust. So it seems like we're sort of in this place where maybe cars are lagging a bit in what's happening in other spaces with LED lighting.
Yeah, well, one thing to keep in mind as well is that one of the struggles with lighting, I mean, we've seen in our testing, visibility has increased, but we've seen glare also decrease. So, you know, for the 2017 model, year, we had about 1 in 5 cars had excessive glare. You look at that for the 2023 model, that's really dropped to about 5 or 6%. But the challenge is, you know, the average age for vehicles now is 12 to 13 years. And so even if new cars, 23, 24 model year vehicles, have improved design for visibility or glare, you know, it's going to take 12 or 13 years before those vehicles really start to, you know, so we start to see most of them in the fleet. And so no matter what the technology, what the problem is, you know, we're going to see a 10 plus year lag for most of these vehicles, you know, to be on the market. in the U.S.
We're talking with David Ehler, who's Vice President of Active Safety for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. He oversees their headlight testing program, and we're talking with him about the challenges of LED headlights. Let me share some listener comments that have come in, and you can join with your email at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk or call us at 866-893-5722. Leanne in El Sereno writes, forget oncoming traffic. When someone with LED headlights gets behind you in stop and go traffic, you'll be blinded by their headlights in your mirror until they or you change lanes. Manny in Yorba Linda emailed, most often it's tall vehicles that blind me. That just a few inches higher light placement makes a big difference. I'd like to install a switch so I could flash my backup lights to tell them to dim it. It's amazing how modern headlights have such a sharp cutoff pattern. Perhaps engineers could work on the pattern of the high beam. I understand the LED requirement was less than 85 watts for incandescents. An 85-watt LED would be really bright. I assume the wattage is cut considerably. That's part of the big advantage with LEDs, is it takes much less power to generate the LED light. David Ehler, can you respond to Larry's comments?
Yeah, so, you know, it is lower wattage, like you said, for power. You know, some of those other comments there, again, you know, we talked about these taller vehicles really create a problem and trying to get manufacturers to aim them in the correct location. In terms of, you know, the sharp cutoff and where they're aimed, manufacturers are working hard at, you know, making sure that, you know, that cutoff sort of where the glare spots are, you know, are appropriately aimed. You know, another thing I'd encourage drivers, you know, to use their mirror, you know, to flip their mirror up to help that some as well. But a big challenge is, as several of your callers mentioned, are, you know, the higher height of vehicles. And, you know, we really like our SUVs in the U.S. market, and there are a lot of them out there, which really creates a problem for headlight glare for sure.
Malika in Santa Monica, good to have you with us. What's your experience with LED headlights?
They drive me absolutely crazy, even during the day, and even low-profile cars just bug my eyeballs.
Even during the day? That's interesting.
Yeah, because everyone leaves their lights on now. They turn off automatically. So, I don't know. I'm almost 70, and my brain, I guess, hasn't adjusted to the LED yet, but they really drive me crazy.
And I'm not sure it's age. Malika, I was going to say, I'm not sure it's age-related, because my sense, and this is only anecdotal, I'd be interested in what your thoughts are, David, is that there are just some people who do have a higher degree of sensitivity, particularly to that highly white blue part of the spectrum that these LED headlights use. David?
Yeah, so, you know, age does play an impact. And, you know, one of the challenges, your eyes are a muscle. And, you know, as we age, you know, your pupil doesn't open and close or dilate, you know, sort of as quickly as it did when you were younger. I definitely, you know, struggle with that as well. And so glare can be more distracting, right? Because your eye doesn't adjust to that change in light as quickly. And we, you know, not only do we have an increasing SUV population in the U.S., we also have a increasing sort of age population in the U.S. And so I think that is also some of the struggle, is just the increased age of our driving population.
David, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Anything else just to add in how this is working itself out with car manufacturers?
Yeah, so, I mean, as I mentioned before, you know, this is going to be a long process as, you know, the vehicle fleet starts to turn over. But based on our data, you know, we are seeing manufacturers increase their visibility while at the same time reducing glare. And so we're hopeful that, you know, that increased visibility, that, which we know reduces crashes at night, will increase it in continue to increase, but at the same time reducing glare. And so we look forward to those improvements over the next, you know, 5, 10 plus years.
Our producer Manny asks about reflection of the light on rain slick streets, because I think what Manny's saying is that there seems to be a higher degree of reflection of the wet road with LEDs than without. Do you know if that's true?
I'm not sure if that's true. I mean, obviously, you know, any sort of reflection, moisture on the road can create problems with any lighting. But I don't know of any data specific to that problem.
All right. Michael in the city of Orange emailed, "I can't stand LED lights, especially on high-profile trucks and SUVs. To me, the lights cause more risk on the road for everyone, far over what owners think in terms of an advantage for visibility." That's Michael in Orange. David Ehler, thank you very much. Appreciate your talking with us about the testing your organization does of LED headlights, the feedback that you give to manufacturers, and some of the changes they might make as a result of that.
Thanks for having me.
From the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, VP of Active Safety, David Ehler. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we talk about the history of African-American artists in country music. Beyoncé, just a few days ago, released her first ever country album. We'll play from that, as well as some of the favorites, some of the great artists over the years who either work primarily in country music, like Charlie Pride or others, who made country albums in addition to working in other genres, like the great Ray Charles. All coming up in just 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus. Ooh. And throw your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round.
Stick around.
And I'll be damned if I can't slow dance with you. Ooh. Come pour some sugar on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a b- come take it to the floor now. Woo! There's a tornado.
Ooh, there's a tornado
in my city.
In my city.
In the basement.
The basement.
That ain't pretty.
Pretty.
Rugged whiskey.
Rugged whiskey.
We surviving.
We surviving.
A red cup kisses, sweet redemption, passing time, yeah. Ooh. One step.
That's a new single off Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, which released just days ago. Beyonce's become the first black woman artist to ever top Billboard's country music chart. Cowboy Carter is fully embracing of country and includes collaborations with Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, includes a mention of the Chitlin Circuit, that era of black entertainment venues, particularly in the American South. One of the songs is titled The Linda Martell Show, after the performer who became the first black woman to play the Grand Ole Opry. With us to talk not just about the significance of Beyoncé's new album, but the long history of black artists in country music, Tammy Kernodle, who is professor of music at Miami University in Ohio. Also with us, Alice Randall, Vanderbilt University professor of African American and Diaspora Studies, and author of the forthcoming book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. Professors Kernodle and Randall, thank you both very much for being with us. Professor Kernodle, let me start with you. Just the significance of an artist as huge as Beyoncé doing a country album.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you and to be in conversation with Professor Randall. You know, this is, I think, a moment in time where we're really seeing the full spectrum of artistry that comes with Beyoncé. You know, this is a country album, but she reminds us that this is a Beyoncé album. And with her invoking that kind of context for understanding the music that you hear on this album, I think it just speaks to the fact that she recognizes the agency that she has as an artist and her ability to really challenge what are some of these genres distinctions and some of these musical boxes that have limited artists since the founding, the genesis of recorded sound.
Is blues a root music that we see influencing both African-American rhythm and blues and gospel music, as well as country music, which has been predominantly made by white artists? Is there a common root?
Yes, and I think, you know, that's such an excellent question. I think, you know, we don't consider the blues as important as it should be considered. You know, the blues is really an aquifer for most of American music as a whole. And I think it the larger conversation is about how Black music has really framed much of what we consider American music. You know, the sound of the spiritual and the blues, and the fact that, you know, Africans, enslaved Africans who were part of this American experience initially did not see those distinctions of the sacred or the secular. And so there is a commonality between those sounds, but then how those sounds informed a sound world that was not only Black, but was white, and how those musics became the basis of a larger cultural dialogue that happened amongst different ethnic and racial individuals within this American experience, and thus informed so many different forms of music. It's not just about the licks. It's not just about the instruments. It's not just about sound, but it's also about the deeper stories that are embedded in blues culture that then informs what are these other genres of music that we talk about.
We're speaking with Professor Tammy Kernodle of Miami University in Ohio. She's professor of music and specializes in African-American music. Also with us is Vanderbilt professor Alice Randall, her forthcoming book, My Black Country. Professor Randall, you know, when I think of an artist working pretty much exclusively in country who's Black, I think of the late Charlie Pride, someone who actually, you know, began his career as a minor league baseball player for the Angels and ended up with a, you know, of course, a huge country music career. How important is Charlie Pride in terms of African-American entree to the genre?
Charlie Pride is very important because he will become in 1971 Entertainer of the Year for the Country Music Association. So he has achieved pinnacle status in the industry, acknowledged by the industry almost uniquely. He will get into the Country Music Hall of Fame rotunda before Ray Charles, before Dee Ford Bailey. However, I think it's very important to understand that metaphorically, Charlie Pride is, for me, the love child of Dee Ford Bailey. It's very important to note that the recorded country story begins 1927, when we have Dee Ford Bailey as the Opry's first superstar, not first Black superstar, but first superstar, period. And in 1930, we have Lil Hardin playing in Los Angeles on Blue Yodel Number 9, which is considered to be the most iconic country single of all time. It's a million seller, but Lil Hardin Armstrong, a Black woman born in Memphis, is on every bar of that song. So I think of Ray Charles, who you've mentioned, as their genius child, but Dee Ford's side child is Country as Cornbread, Charlie Pride. But we also have Herb Jeffries coming in the 30s and 40s, who is gonna be the bronze buckaroo. And he is going to do race movies that have singing Black cowboys in them. And those five people, which Lil Hardin Armstrong, D. Fort Bailey, the Mama and the Papa, Ray Charles, the Genius Child, Herb Jeffries, Lil Stepchild, and Charlie Pride, the immortal Charlie Pride, is going to be the direct link from D. Fort to the current country stars who are fully rooted in the genre.
Wow.
And not coming like Ray Charles or Beyonce from another genre.
I want to hear just a little bit of Charlie Pride so we can remember his voice. I just have to mention that I actually shared a barber with Herb Jeffries, which was what later in his life, I was, which a great thrill to have the same hands that cut my hair cut his. Let's listen. This song written by Ben Peters, recorded by American country music artist Charlie Pride, 1971.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder how does a man get to be this way. I've always got a smiling face, anytime and any place, and every time they ask me why, I just smile and say, you've got to kiss an angel good morning. Let her know you think about her when you're gone.
Big hit for Charlie Pride. It's Air Talk on LA. It's 89.3. We're talking about African-American artists in country music, either like Charlie Pride, for whom that was his home genre in which he primarily worked, others like the great Ray Charles, who did, of course, a wide range of recordings, jazz, rhythm and blues. And this was a huge hit. I Can't Stop Loving You, reaching number one on the Billboard chart, originally written by Don Gibson in 1957, recorded later by Ray Charles.
I can't stop loving you. I've made up my mind to live in memory of the lonesome time.
We'll come back and continue with our expert guests as we talk about African-American artists in country music just days after the release of Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter record. You're listening to Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Back in a minute.
Listening to Linda Martell. A year after this song was an R&B hit for the Winstons, she released her cover version of Color Him Father. As one of the first African-American country performers, Martell helped influence the careers of future Nashville artists of color. That's our topic during this portion of Air Talk. So pleased to be joined by Vanderbilt University professor Alice Randall, author of the forthcoming book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future, and Professor Tammy Kernodle of the Miami University in Ohio. She's professor of music and a specialist in African-American music. Professor Kernodle, let's talk a bit about, you know, these earlier your artist decades ago, when there were so few Black artists operating in country music, what kind of reception did they receive in what was a white-dominated music genre?
Well, oftentimes, you know, they in some ways splintered audiences. But I think, you know, can I answer your question by talking about the construction of the industry?
Yes, of course.
And really what codifies as the country song, because early country recording, you know, which precipitates in the late 20s, you know, was really about song catching or song curation that was centered around the folk traditions that people came out of. So when you look at the Carter family, you look at those 1927 historic Bristol sessions that were referenced earlier, you know, the songs that were recorded were coming out of the ritualized lives of people who lived in particular regions or areas, right? The Piedmont region. And so, you know, country music initially really did not have a structured identity, because they were recording everything from Appalachian ballads that had been passed down to these cowboy songs to, you know, instrumental traditions that were rooted in string band traditions and Appalachian fiddle tunes and hymns. And there's a lot of curation that's happening between whites and Blacks, A.P. Carter, Leslie Riddle. And so, you know, the sound of what becomes country music is very eclectic. It's not until we start to move into the middle and the latter part of the 20th century that it becomes codified around a certain number of traits and emblems and sounds. And so country music is representative of a larger cultural phenomenon that's happening in a recording industry where they are creating a sonic color line. And so, you know, when you match that with the physicality of people on stage as country moves from records and radio into this live music format, you have Black artists who, you know, whose records are being heard, whose performances might be heard on radio, but it's not until they show up that they are identified as Black that you have this tension that begins to emerge. It's one of the central reasons why, you know, when we think about why Black performers are sometimes absent from these chapters, it has a lot to do with the mechanism in which this music was disseminated against. 1930s is radio. It's these barn dance variety shows,
yeah.
You know, like the Grand Ole Opry, you know, but they were touring as well. And that touring aspect of this culture in Jim Crow America, in many ways, created and necessitated for Black performers in some ways to be absent. DeFord Bailey is there, but we have to talk about DeFord Bailey's challenges in working in Jim Crow America and how segregation almost made it impossible for him to cultivate the same type of audience, but also even to navigate the act of touring in the way that his white counterparts did. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those radio shows coalesce into tours, but they also coalesce into the television culture. So you mentioned Linda Martell, who shows up on Hee Haw in 1969, right? But is country television really ready for her, particularly at a time when country music is being scripted and branded in this notion of whiteness, patriotism, conservative values, religion, and is seen as a counter or a challenge to the social justice, racial reconciliation narratives that are coming out of other forms of popular culture during the late 60s and 70s.
We're talking with Professor Tammy Kernodle and Professor Alice Randall. Professor Randall, we're getting very tight on time, but I did want to ask you, and you alluded this a bit earlier, the important role of Los Angeles in country music by Black artists.
Well, I think of Los Angeles as actually the capital of Black country. And it's for a lot of the reasons that Professor Kernodle has touched on. We get very important gospel coming out of Los Angeles, the Apostolic Mission Church, the Azusa Street Revival. We get the amazing That the music coming out of that church is going to have a huge influence on country. We are going to have this, the Bronze Buckaroo. But in fact, I think about the Herb Jeffries, Bill Withers, Ray Charles, Lionel Richie, two members of the founding family of Black country, and two of their shiniest descendants, Bill Withers and Richie, they set up root in Los Angeles. And together they have almost 210 years of performance in country in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And so it's actually, so we're seeing both some of the very early, if we go back to the 18th century, that with the very first people who are arriving in Los Angeles in 1781, those pobladores arriving from Mexico to what we now call Greater Los Angeles, we think that six of those original 11 founding families had African ancestry.
Wow.
And I want to say, what did they sing?
Yeah, real quickly. Yeah. What did they sing?
Well, we know that some of the cowboy songs that get connected later, but I have to take one point of personal privilege and say, Professor Knuddle, do you know that you have a starring role in my book in the Kansas City chapter? And yes, I have to say that in Kansas City, chasing that over time, I discover a favorite scholar of mine, Dr. Tammy Kernodle of the University of Miami. And I have this whole thing about you and the Southwestern jazz scene. So you have a beautiful, you are really my favorite scholar in this area. And I'm thrilled that Air Talk put me on with you. I can't wait to meet you.
Oh, this is great. Thank you both so much. Professor Alice Randall of Vanderbilt, Professor Tammy Kernodle, Miami University, Ohio. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Stanford University professor and the author of Cultures of Growth, How the New Science of Mindset Can Transform Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. We'll talk about what that means and the growth mindset as it's portrayed, what the potential advantages of that can be for business or any other type of organization. But we are going to begin with a story that was broken yesterday by Howard Bloom of the Los Angeles Times about teachers' unions in California joining with the former superintendent of the LA Unified School District, Austin Buettner, in calling for the state of California to look in at how public school districts are spending Proposition 28 money. That ballot measure, which was approved by voters back in the fall of 2022, established a significant floor for spending on additional arts programming. And that is additional, not that they could use Proposition 28 funds to fund already available arts programs and then move that money that had been designated for arts into something else. Joining us to talk about it is Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Howard, thank you for being with us. So what is the gist of the allegation being made by the unions and by Austin Buettner?
I think you said it very well. That is that the money is supposed to be used for additional arts instruction, not just to fill in budget gaps to save money elsewhere. And the allegation is that districts are not doing it. Now, some districts are using that arts money for additional arts instruction, but the claim in the letter is that other districts are not. And there's a strong implication that one of those districts is LA Unified, which of course is the second largest district in the country and the big district in LA County.
And of course, the district that Austin Buettner had led, and he was the author of Proposition 28, so certainly has an interest in seeing how it's implemented. Austin, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Now, how did you find out how these districts are spending their Prop 28 money? Because, I mean, as you know better than anyone else, because you were on the inside, getting financial information like this is not easy.
Well, as you said in the outset, we created this to add to arts programs. As Howard said, not to replace, but to add. And we started hearing from some school districts, shout out to San Diego, Compton, Englewood, Bakersfield, about the additional teachers they were bringing to help provide more arts instruction to kids. And we also started hearing from school staff in particular and families saying, hang on a sec, where's my teacher? I'm like in the old days, where's my MTV? Where's my teacher? Because the litmus test of all of this, if you're spending Prop 28 money, should be an additional teacher or aide, arts teacher, arts aide instructionally in the school. In certain school districts, it's not been happening. What they've been doing is going to schools and saying, we're cutting your funding for your existing position. Use your Prop 28 money to backfill for that. That's against the law. It should be, congratulations, you have more money to add to the program you have. What kind of program do you want to add?
Well, in this, yeah, I mean, this would not be the first time that we've seen funds fungibly been used, you know, moved to other parts of the budget. Is Proposition 28 ironclad in the way it lays out that this money would have to be used only for additional programs, or is there wiggle room in here, Austin, for districts?
Absolutely ironclad. We had a bunch of smart people, some of the labor partners you mentioned, plus artists and community arts organizations all got together with us when we wrote the law. Once we started hearing about the allegations, we sat down with a bunch of smart lawyers and litigators and looked at it and said, tell us what it says. And it says in plain language, more arts and music at every school. Here's money for each school to add to their programs. You may not use the money to replace existing funding. That's what the law says. Now, it's a simple law. We wrote a law that's just a couple pages. We didn't write 4,000 pages of which you cannot do. Sort of like when you go to a bank, there's no sign above each bank which says, do not rob this bank. We assumed a simple law would be enforced and the will of the voters would be enacted on by school districts. What's been happening is not that. And there's actually a longstanding precedent from the California Supreme Court which says laws are what they say they are, whether by the legislature enacted or by the will of voters, as Prop 28 was. And 7 million people said, more arts and music in every school. Add teachers to do that. That's what the law says. School districts can't add stuff just because they'd like to, or they think they've got a better angle on it. The will of the voters, crystal clear. The law's crystal clear. That's what it says. And that's what the California Supreme Court has said. It should be enacted.
Austin, what if a district... let's go, let's say, a music teacher, and then hires back that music teacher. In other words, tries to game the system so that then they can say, oh, we added the music teacher because that music teacher had earlier been let go, kind of like how people, you know, cancel their subscriptions to things and then come back later with a new subscriber rate. I mean, is that something that districts could potentially try and get away with here?
Well, that's exactly why we wrote the letter. They're trying to get away with it, but it's unlawful. And so while there are great examples of what good looks like around the state, where teachers are being added to school classrooms, there are examples where school districts have gone to schools and tried to do exactly as what you're saying, taking away funding for the teacher that's already there, forcing the school to use Prop 28 money just to keep the teacher, when the Prop 28 money clearly is supposed to add to the program at school, not replace existing funding. So they're violating law when they're doing that.
What districts are really doing this best?
San Diego, shout out to Ann Fennell, who leads their arts programs. Bakersfield, shout out to Mike Stone, Compton, Englewood, Long Beach. Lots of good examples, and by the way, haves and have-nots. You know, historically, Santa Monica's had a fantastic arts program. Local voters actually tax themselves extra to be able to provide for that. Great. They're adding to their program under the leadership of Tom Whaley. Communities like Englewood, Compton, which historically haven't had the tax base to be able to add, they're getting twice as much funding to make sure that they can not only build a baseline, but add to it, and they're doing that. So there are great examples around the state, and there are also examples, which Howard brings out in his story, of school districts that aren't doing the right thing, and they're, I guess, willfully violating the law.
We're talking with Austin Buettner, the author of Proposition 28 and former superintendent of LA Unified, Howard Bloom, Los Angeles Times staff writer who covers education. Howard, what was LA Unified's response to this?
Their response is that they contend that their overall spending for arts has increased in line with what Prop 28 would require. Now, Austin will tell you that that's not, even if that were true, which I don't think he thinks is true, that the provisions of the law state that it's on a school by school basis. And you can't just say that we are doing arts related things. It's really, the money is supposed to go to the school that's generated by the school. Now, LA Unified says this is not the case, and they point to audit guidelines issued by the California Department of Education that say, that suggests that it's the entire arts picture, not the school by school arts picture. There are other guidelines in the California Department of Education which seem to be very clear that it's a school by school allotment of money. So there is some confusion perhaps, or ambiguity or lack of consistency that perhaps could be clarified here. But I guess Austin's point is that whether CDEs, whatever, regardless of what CDE is saying, the California Department of Education, that the law is still the law. And I think the purpose of the letter is to clarify that to some degree before money can be, as he would see it, misused. That, and once you spend it for the wrong thing, it's going to be very difficult to get that back.
How, Austin, how can this be adjudicated since you've got these competing interpretations of the prop?
Well, first of all, an interpretation is not consistent with what the California Supreme Court said. The law is what the law says. Okay, the law says here's money for each school to add to its program. It says, the law says nothing about what an overall district does. It says that the district is responsible for enforcing and making sure the law is properly implemented. That's the overall for school district. So it's just wrong on the facts. But let's take it a step further and say the litmus test of all this is, where are the teachers? So if a school district like LA Unified is claiming they're spending more on the arts, okay, 80% of the funding by law has to go to school classroom educators. We built a program because we know the best learning happens in school classroom or continuity. So add teachers, add aides. So 80% of the money should translate into an awful lot of new teachers in a school district like LA Unified. And so a simple question, show me the list, show me the teachers, you know, not just show me the money, show me the teachers. And if there aren't more teachers, by definition, they're using it to replace existing spending on existing programs, which violates the law.
$938 million generated by Prop 28 for arts and music programs. I mean, it's an awful lot of money. Did Austin, did you project how many music and arts educators that you thought this would fund in the state?
Yeah, it's right there in the voter guide that voters voted for, as many as 15,000 new arts educators across the state. And to put some dimension on it, it's the largest investment in arts and music in our nation's history. 15,000 arts educators are more than currently teach in California schools, so we should be seeing sort of a doubling. And 15,000 new arts educators is more than will be hired in the rest of the country combined over the next few years.
Wow.
So it's an enormous opportunity to do the right thing by kids, because before Prop 28, barely one in five public schools across California had a full-time arts and music teacher. What Prop 28 will do, if properly enacted and if the law is followed, is to make sure every kid in every school across the state has a chance to receive a proper arts education.
We're talking with Austin Buettner, former LA Unified superintendent and the author of Proposition 28, LA Times staff writer covering education, Howard Bloom, with us as well. Austin, one of the things that I was thinking with Proposition 28 when we were going through the election season was how many artists and musicians this could potentially keep doing their own work, because, of course, you know, for many of them, teaching has been the way that they've been able to financially support themselves as they perform or as they create art. And I assume that's one of the things that you were thinking about with the crafting of this, that the arts benefit too.
Yeah, we all know the benefit of proper arts education. It's the glue that holds an education together. It activates the pathways in the brain that help with literacy and math. It helps with social and emotional. And so there's a tremendous body of literature on what this will do for school kids when they can participate in the arts. And as the number one industry in our state. We're the creative capital, not just in the country, but probably around the world. And this is a chance for artists to continue to pursue their craft while also sharing their skills with kids. You know, one of one is going to be five, because we're going to bring a more diverse, multicultural set of arts practices into our public schools. How wonderful is that? But school children in California, all 6 million of them, will be able to share in that.
Yeah, I remember my orchestra leader at LeConte Junior High School in Hollywood when I was a kid. I played clarinet in the orchestra, and I remember he was all over the place with other groups that he performed with and that he conducted for, and very well-known person in the musical community. And he was our teacher at, you know, at this middle school in Los Angeles. So there's a tremendous amount of crossover with the arts community. Howard, what comes next with this as likely either the state stepping in to resolve this or you know, what happens?
Well, something has got to give, I think, because as Austin Buettner clearly feels that, and he wrote the proposition after all, that it's being handled illegally in many school systems. The school districts, LA Unified, is insisting that it is following the rules according to its interpretation. So one possibility is that the legislature could step in and do something to clarify the law. The legislature can step in on a proposition to further the goals of the proposition. They cannot pass a law that changes the intent of the proposition. There could also be litigation. This could be the first step in litigation over this issue. CDE, the California Department of Education, could offer clearer guidelines, but it does appear that something does have to give here.
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. Howard Bloom, LA Times staff writer who covers education, and Austin Buettner, former LA Unified superintendent and the author of Proposition 28. In case you just joined us, what a couple of the big teachers' unions in California and Mr. Buettner are alleging is that instead of Proposition 28 being used in some districts to add to the arts and music programs, that it instead is being used to provide what currently has always been provided in arts and music, and the money being fungibly going to other areas instead of that money being additive to the arts and music programs. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about a new skin test for Parkinson's, which can help doctors, aside from looking at the symptoms a patient is experiencing, to get objective evidence of what's happening with Parkinson's disease and whether an abnormal protein is detected in that test from the skin. We'll talk about that when we come back in just 1 minute.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Some very good news. A new diagnostic tool for Parkinson's. A skin biopsy that can identify the abnormal protein whose buildup causes the disease. Joining us to talk about the great promise here in the diagnostic process for Parkinson's is Dr. Todd Levine, who's Chief Medical Officer of CND Life Sciences. That's a medical tech company based in Scottsdale, Arizona. They make this Parkinson's skin biopsy. Dr. Levine, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Share with us, please, how this test works.
Yeah, so we've known for about 100 years that if you can look inside the brains of people with Parkinson's disease, you can see the accumulation or the buildup of an abnormal protein that's called alpha-synuclein. What was just discovered really over the past decade is that we have nerves throughout our entire body, and that we can see the buildup of these proteins inside those nerves just below the surface of the skin. So the test is a very small, what we call punch biopsy, just like what a dermatologist might do. It's a very small piece of skin, about a quarter the size of a pencil eraser. And then that tissue is sent from the patient and the patient's doctor to our lab in Arizona. And we process that tissue and we can identify this abnormal protein.
And can this help to be able to definitively diagnose Parkinson's versus Lewy body dementia or other diseases that might have similar symptoms?
Yeah, so the test is really used in conjunction with the patient's clinical picture. So as you point out, there actually are several different diseases where this abnormal protein called alpha-synuclein builds up. The most common that we know of is Parkinson's disease, but the second most common is dementia with Lewy bodies, which is the dementia that Robin Williams passed away from. There also are two other rarer conditions called multiple system atrophy and pure autonomic failure. And all of these can have the same buildup of the protein inside the nerves. So what the clinician does, the doctor, the nurse practitioner, the physician assistant, is to take the patient's clinical picture, what kind of symptoms they're having. So are they looking like a patient with Parkinson's with a tremor and shuffling, or are they having more memory problems and hallucinations suggestive of dementia with Lewy bodies? Then this test provides an objective determination that those symptoms are associated with the abnormal accumulation of this protein. And by putting those two pieces together, the clinical picture and the pathological picture, we're able to make a much more objective diagnosis.
In doing autopsies of people who've died diagnosed with Parkinson's or other similar diseases with similar symptoms, what do we understand about the degree to which Parkinson's has been undiagnosed or misdiagnosed?
Yeah, so it is a significant problem. And the reason for that is that there is Parkinson's disease, and then there are many diseases that have what we call Parkinsonian features. So they look similar to Parkinson's disease, but are not the same. And we just have not had good objective tests that we can use during a patient's lifetime to be able to say we're confident this is Parkinson's disease, or we think it's one of the other Parkinsonian diseases. Therefore, when we do autopsy studies of large series of people that have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, we find about 20 to 30% of the time that diagnosis is wrong. And then to your point, we also find patients that have been told they have Parkinsonian features, but not Parkinson's disease. And about 10 to 15% of the time, that actually turns out to be Parkinson's disease. And there are very different symptomatic medications that we use for Parkinson's disease versus the other Parkinsonian diseases. So it's very important for us to be sure that before we start a patient down a pathway of certain treatments, that we're as confident as we can be about the diagnosis. And we're very hopeful that this SYN1 test, that's the name of the test that we provide, can help clinicians make that more objective diagnosis.
And this test, is it typically covered by insurance?
So actually, we are a participating provider with Medicare and TRICARE. It uses standard pathology codes, so it's not really new the way that insurance providers look at that. So about 85 to 90% of the time, either Medicare or private payers will cover most or all of the test.
Is there any benefit to people who don't have symptoms of Parkinson's taking the test just to see if there's something there that would indicate they're likely to have symptoms of Parkinson's later in life?
So we don't really recommend it as a screening tool, which means it's not really designed for people that have no symptoms. We are very hopeful that it may help in an earlier diagnosis. So right now, there are several different features which lead a doctor to say, okay, I think you have Parkinson's disease. But it's not like those all just start on day one. Those gradually develop over time. And so we're hopeful that with this test, if patients have a few of the symptoms of Parkinson's, that we might be able to detect this earlier. And in fact, we're doing two additional NIH-funded studies to really look at those earlier disease states as a way of trying to identify patients earlier in the disease course. And there are certain types of modifications in terms of patients' diet. We know that exercise can help slow the progression of Parkinson's. So we do feel like the earlier you get that objective evidence, the better. But it's not yet really to be used as a screening tool.
Rob in the Mid-Wilshire District contacted us, say that we have a family member with essential tremor. That person's been told there's a 20% chance of that turning into Parkinson's, but the neurologist is reluctant to do this skin test. Why might that be? Rob asked. Dr. Levine?
Yeah, so it's a great question. We are actually involved in another study that is really trying to solidify those numbers. In other words, is essential tremor, which has always been called benign tremor, meaning it leads to a tremor but doesn't lead to the worsening symptoms that you might see in a person that has Parkinson's disease. So the question really is that a risk factor for Parkinson's disease? And I would say right now, the answer to that question is really uncertain, although we're trying to help answer that question. So I think if a physician is confident that a patient has essential tremor, that they're not showing any of the features of Parkinson's disease, this test may not be indicated for that person. On the other hand, in the case of a person who has essential tremor, who's starting to show some of the features of Parkinson's, that's where this test might actually have some value to say, yes, we are worried that something else might be developing.
If you'd like to talk with our guests about this test, a skin biopsy that can identify an abnormal protein whose buildup causes Parkinson's, give us a call. We're at 866-893-5722. You can also email your question to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. In addition to Dr. Todd Levine of CND Life Sciences, based in Scottsdale, Arizona, we're joined by Dr. Christopher Gibbons, neurologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Gibbons is professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and lead author of a study on the Parkinson's skin test. Dr. Gibbons, we appreciate you being with us. Just anything else to add about the promise of what this test provides?
Larry, thank you very much for the opportunity. We think this test really holds a whole, you know, wealth of opportunity for us, both as scientists and as physicians. One of the biggest challenges we face when designing clinical trials to help treat these, you know, these diseases is really to find people as early as possible. If we identify Parkinson's as early as we can, that gives us a better opportunity to potentially alter the disease history or the trajectory of the disease. So if we can intervene early, that's wonderful. But as Dr. Levine mentioned, that's also the hardest time to make an accurate diagnosis. So if you're trying to get people in a clinical trial and you're sort of at a 50-50 chance of knowing whether they have Parkinson's disease or something else, that really can impair your trial's ability to actually show that a drug might work. So this is an area where scientifically we think will be an enormous benefit in the future.
What sorts of treatments are available now that appear to be most effective for people at various stages of Parkinson's?
So largely when we talk about Parkinson's, most people think about the movement aspects of it, so that the tremor, the kind of the gait difficulty or walking difficulty. And most of that, the treatment is designed around what we call dopamine replacement therapies. So medications that supplement your body's natural amount of dopamine, because that's the area of the brain that's often impacted. But it turns out that's actually only one of many problems that occur in Parkinson's disease. There are what we call non-motor things that people exhibit as well. And so a very common problem is constipation or bladder dysfunction or trouble with blood pressure control. So all of these things might be problems that have to be addressed and considered. But most of these are what we refer to as symptomatic therapies. So we try a treatment to improve the person's symptoms, but unfortunately we don't have any treatments that really change the disease or slow the disease from progressing.
Michael J. Fox, of course, very famous for Parkinson's, his diagnosis at a very young age, and he's lived decades now with it. But I'm wondering, with the aging population, are we seeing an increase in Parkinson's just because the median age of the population is rising?
It's a great point. You know, as we talk about the shift in the population, you know, age as the kind of the baby boomers grow older, we do know that age is, of course, the largest risk factor for something like Parkinson's disease. And so we will see increases in numbers as the population moves in that direction. So it is going to be a challenging topic for all neurologists and, you know, physicians in general, as we have more people with these conditions.
Just as we see, of course, dementia increase dramatically as the population ages. Again, if you have questions for our guests, physicians Dr. Todd Levine and Dr. Christopher Gibbons, also researchers in addition to being physicians, we're at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Dr. Gibbons, is it your sense that these treatments that are available, dopamine replacement therapies or other treatments, are making progress on treating symptoms, even if they're not bringing about a cure in Parkinson's?
Well, there's no question we have made, you know, significant improvements in managing symptoms. You know, as physicians, the more we learn, the better we become at treating. Medications are we're getting varieties of ways to administer medications. There are things like brain stimulators that are now used for more severe disease. So there are lots of things that people can do that allow us to control symptoms better. So, you know, clearly we've been making progress, but it's unfortunately, it's not the same, of course, as stopping or curing the disease. But the good news is there are a lot of treatment trials that are going on to look at new therapies that might actually, again, slow down the progression of a disease like Parkinson's.
Do we understand why certain people, like Michael J. Fox, for example, seemingly the progress of the Parkinson's has been delayed in his case versus others for whom it's a much more rapid progression and ultimately to death from Parkinson's? Do we know why that is?
Well, there are a lot of factors that kind of are involved in kind of considering how a disease may progress. One of the big variables is a genetic predisposition. So some people have what we call a genetic form of Parkinson's disease, a mutation that either leads to this particular protein or leads to a variation in this protein that accumulates. Some of these mutations can be more or less aggressive. But the vast majority of people actually have what we call idiopathic Parkinson's disease. So it's not genetic related. It's just due to, you know, a combination of environmental and other risk factors. And the natural history for most people is a slowly progressive course over, you know, 2 to 3 decades of things progressing. Certainly there are therapies that can really be quite advanced that can potentially alter your symptoms a little bit. And I think Michael J. Fox has clearly, you know, really been at the forefront of leading this charge into, you know, new therapeutic development. So we continue to see, though, big variations in access to care as well across the United States. And so that's one of the big challenges we have to consider.
Alana in Altadena emailed, my question is whether or not the skin biopsy test can be useful in cases where familial types of Parkinsonian diseases are suspected. I come from a family where my father was diagnosed with pure autonomic failure, his brother with multiple system atrophy, and his sister with an undiagnosed Parkinsonian system. I'm always curious about how these things may manifest down the line. Dr. Levine?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what those diseases do have in common is the accumulation of this protein. And as Dr. Gibbons pointed out, we definitely see families where these diseases can kind of run together. That would suggest that there is some type of genetic predisposition and then potentially other environmental or other risk factors that we're not quite so sure of. Again, I think for patients in those types of families, the first thing to do would be really to discuss with your physician and sort of try to understand what the result might mean. Finding that abnormal protein in a person that has symptoms, beginning to develop the symptoms that other family members shared, would certainly suggest that they are potentially at risk for developing more symptoms as time goes by. We don't yet know exactly what the predictive value is if someone has no symptoms. Again, going back to that question about, do we use this as kind of a screening tool?
Yeah.
And so that would be a conversation that you'd want to have with your doctor and just go through the pros and the cons of doing the test.
Thank you both for being with us. Appreciate it very much. That's Dr. Todd Levine, Chief Medical Officer, CND Life Sciences, the company that makes the Parkinson's skin biopsy. And our thanks to Beth Israel, Deaconess Medical Center neurologist, Dr. Christopher Gibbons. He's also professor of neurology at Harvard Medical and the lead author of a study on the Parkinson's skin test we've been talking about. Coming up on LAist, we'll talk with Stanford University professor Mary C. Murphy. She's the author of Cultures of Growth, How the New Science of Mindset Can Transform Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Hair Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us as we're joined by social psychologist Mary C. Murphy, who is professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University and the founding director of the Summer Institute on Diversity at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, also the founder and CEO of the Equity Accelerator. And Professor Murphy's new book is titled Cultures of Growth, How the New Science of Mindset Can Transform Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. Professor Murphy, very good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
We hear a lot about the growth mindset, the idea of being open to growth, working together with others, expanding our horizons. Share with us how Cultures of Growth takes that concept and builds upon it.
That's right. So for about 30 years, we've thought of mindset largely in our mind. But for the last 15 or so, we have discovered that mindset is so impacted by the people around us and different situations and settings, the clubs we're a part of, the organizations, the teams, and that these places have mindset cultures. And that really affects whether we're operating more from our fixed or our growth mindset. And so Cultures of Growth really takes a look at how to build those growth mindset cultures and some of the dangers of these more fixed-minded, what I call cultures of genius.
Yeah, let's talk about cultures of genius, because I have to say one of the things I love about working with LAist is I work with such bright people and they have tremendous open-mindedness, creativity, mental flexibility, and just, yes. I mean, frankly, a lot of intellectual horsepower. And it makes it a great working environment. And so when I think of cultures of genius, and you sort of use it in a negative context, I think of, I work around all these very bright people, and it's pretty dynamic. I actually like that, and I think we kind of seek that out. So maybe elaborate on that notion of culture of genius.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, to your experience, you know, the highest performers actually prefer these growth-minded cultures of growth. And why is that? It's because the culture of genius really takes to its heart the idea that there are some people, a few people, who are the stars, the star performers. They're the resident genius. And all of the power, all of the resources are kind of tuned around this person. That person sets the strategy, everyone else just implements it. And the problem with the culture of genius is that our cultural stereotypes about who looks, sounds, and has the background of the genius is extremely narrow. When we Google image search genius, the first person you're going to see, of course, is going to be who? It's going to be
Elon Musk.
Einstein.
No, I don't know.
It's going to be Elon Musk. Yeah, that's right.
He's everywhere these days. I don't know.
Yes, absolutely. And you might see Steve Jobs. You might see Bill Gates. For sure, you're going to see a lot of Einstein. Well, these people have particular characteristics in common, right? And it leaves out women, people of color, people with disabilities, you know, anyone with any level of difference. And so what we see is that in these cultures of genius, we're looking to recruit, promote, and elevate these geniuses. And that means that we're going to have a much narrower band for who we actually identify as genius. We're going to miss a lot of hidden talent. And we're actually going to always be competing against each other, because in a culture of genius, a new star is born every day. And so I'm always looking over my shoulder to say, you know, is that person smarter than me? How can I show that I'm the smartest one in the room? And this, of course, leads to all kinds of ethical problems. When we look at who are the culture of genius poster children, you can sort of see Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos, Adam Neumann at WeWork, right? Uber under the previous leadership, right? SBF at FTX, right? We see these geniuses, and you see how the whole organization is surrounded by them and how people will do anything, including engaging in a lot of these unethical practices in order to maintain their status and reputation as the genius, the person who has it, the star in these organizations. And it's why really high performers who want to take their performance and elevate it to the next level by collaborating with others, by innovating, by making mistakes and learning from them, and by being super creative, they're going to find that they can do that more effectively in the culture of growth.
And what are examples, Professor, of those individuals, the sort of counter to the Elizabeth Holmes?
Yeah, well, we see a lot of examples. I mean, Microsoft, of course, is the example that a lot of people like to point to, because the current CEO, Satya Nadella, was inspired by Carol Dweck's original research on mindset and said, Microsoft is going to be the first growth mindset company in the world. And we can see how that actual mindset culture has been built over time and has actually created a lot of success and given a lot of resilience. When tech stocks go down, Microsoft oftentimes is insulated from that. But other examples, I don't know if you've heard of the McBride sisters, but the McBride sisters are two women. They're Black women, and they were interested in breaking into the wine industry. Now, the wine industry is one of the largest cultures of genius. I mean, literal family legacies of hundreds of years, passed down, networks of distributions, right? How do we break in as outsiders to this kind of industry? And so they built a culture of growth around themselves. They engaged in new collaborations. They literally built a body of consumers who had been overlooked by the wine industry as wine consumers and drinkers. And so they built a consumer base of people of color, largely Black people and Latinx people and others who are interested in, you know, pursuing this interest in wine. And they are now the largest Black-owned wine company in the whole United States. And so you can see how, you know, being entrepreneurial, really engaging in new collaborations, innovative approaches, looking outside of the typical stereotypes as to who is going to be our consumer base can create this culture of growth and lead to a tremendous success in our pursuits.
We're talking with Mary C. Murphy, author of Cultures of Growth, How the New Science of Mindset Can Transform Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. She's a professor both at Indiana University and also at Stanford. She's the founding director of the Summer Institute on Diversity. If you have questions for her, we're at 866-893-5722. Or you can email them at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. So I want to let you know that, you know, coming up next Monday, it's going to be the total eclipse, not here in Southern California, it'll be only partial, but we're going to have live NPR coverage right after Air Talk next Monday from 11 until 1 o'clock, 2 full hours. You'll be hearing reports from the areas where the path of totality moves, total darkness, during the eclipse next Monday, April 8th. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll be back in just 1 minute. NPR's Here and Now comes up next. Stay tuned for that. And of course, Fresh Air with Terry Gross at noon here on LAist 89.3. Right now, we're talking with the author of Cultures of Growth, How the New Science of Mindset Can Transform Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. The author, Mary C. Murphy, is both a professor in psychological and brain sciences at Indiana University. She's a social psychologist by her training. And she's also the head and founding director of the Summer Institute on Diversity at Stanford University, and has her own firm as well that she leads, a research and consulting organization. Let's continue, Professor, by talking about flexibility of thinking. I mean, something that I think many of us who are involved in hiring decisions really want. We value creativity. We want flexible thinkers, people who are open-minded, who will challenge themselves, and who are willing to be challenged in a respectful way by other people. How do you identify that trait in someone else?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the problems that we have is that we think that it's a trait inside us to be identified, instead of thinking about how do we create the environment where that becomes the norm and everybody kind of moves toward their growth mindset and are able to be flexible thinkers, are given the structures and the resources to make some mistakes, to try something new, even if we might fail at it. And so, you know, I really kind of think about what are we doing in our teams, in our recruiting, in our onboarding, and in our organizations largely to enable the most flexible thinkers to be successful here and to actually rub off on others in these norms kind of way. And so one of the things we see is that, you know, when you're in these cultures of growth, you see people willing to try new things. They're willing to put ideas together in different ways. They're willing to engage in difficult conversations. One of the biggest misunderstandings people have about a growth-minded culture of growth is that it's just rainbows and unicorns and just so nice to each other, always affirming. In fact, it can be just the opposite. It's one of the most rigorous environments where ideas are challenged and where there's enough psychological safety there that people feel like they can raise questions about the approach, questions about what we're doing, and to give new ideas and information. So we see better ideas are actually being surfaced in the culture of growth than in these cultures of genius, where people are afraid of making mistakes because any mistake is taken as a sign that maybe we don't have it. Maybe we're not the talented star that everybody thought that we were. And so you see much more closed-mindedness, much more inflexible thinking, much less willingness to take risks in the culture of genius than in the culture of growth.
How then do you effectively weigh the ideas? Because for me, kind of one of the downsides I think of with the growth mindset is sort of everybody's telling, quote, my truth, and which to me is a misnomer in the first place, because there is such a thing as objective truth. You have experiences, but it's not necessarily true because you experience something and interpret it in a given way. So how do you develop a protocol to respectfully and not discouraging creativity to sort of weigh how experience factors into decisions that organizations have to make?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in a true culture of growth, a strong culture of growth, what we're going to see is that people actually use data to make decisions. It's a much more rigorous environment because we can lay out all of the different options on the table, all the ideas that have been surfaced. Okay, we have option A, option B, option C. And then we start to say, okay, what is going to be the evidence that if we pursue option A, we've made the right choice? What's going to show us early in signs in our data that we're going to collect that shows that the effort we're putting forward is actually effectively moving us towards our goal? And then with all of the options on the table and the data that's going to tell us whether we've made the correct or incorrect decision, if we need to pivot, all of that is understood, and you can actually make decisions more quickly in that environment and more rigorously assess earlier so that you have time to pivot if you've made the wrong decision to something else. Contrast that with the strong culture of genius, right? There, we see these environments are so much more risky, ironically, because the risk in that situation is that the decision is made usually by the resident genius's gut, rather than actually looking at data, rather than actually considering all the options on the table and then making a choice based on that. It's based on whatever the resident genius kind of feels or thinks that day. And that can have wild swings for the organization. You mentioned Elon Musk earlier. There's some good examples of that, right? Where the very strong changes in the organizational pursuits and structure have created incredible risk for certain companies. The consequences of that, that you see in a culture of genius are not uncommon. So I'd say that culture of growth really allows you to look at the options, make a choice, decide early what our measures, our metrics for success are going to be, and then being sure that we're checking in with those on a regular basis so we can pivot earlier. And that's why they're so much more effective, efficient, and learn more quickly. And that's why their bottom line tends to be much more successful.
I wonder, though, and I don't have any firsthand knowledge or expertise. This just sort of, I wonder if when you look at, say, the NASA model, where there are lots of committees, is very much a group process. You look at SpaceX, which I'm sure has their committees and group process, but you have someone at the helm in an Elon Musk. Does that give them an ability to do things more quickly than, let's say, NASA's governmental model? I don't know. I just wonder.
Yeah. You know, I think that there are some structures. It's not that a culture of genius can ever be it's not that a culture of genius will never be successful. In fact, we have some good examples of cultures of genius that are successful. But what I'll say is that in our studies, what it's like is that these cultures of genius are kind of flying through headwind, right? Their expenditures are greater. They're likely to be delayed. It's going to be a more stressful journey, a more bumpy journey, right? That's going to have a lot of failures along the way to some successes. And so I do think that some of these cultures of genius, they have different kinds of policies and practices that make their ability, if they're able to learn from those failures, they can have some success, but they'll have more of these kinds of ups and downs on the way to success. I'll also note that most companies, what we have seen, most organizations are some mixture of a culture of growth and a culture of genius. And so while you might have a macro culture of genius with a particular genius at the helm, the people on the ground actually doing the work and learning and engaging and taking risks and innovating, there can be these micro cultures of growth that actually are kind of the bedrock for supporting the larger organization as a whole. And I bet that's what's happening there.
Thank you so much, Mary C. Murphy. We really appreciate you being with us and talking about your book, Cultures of Growth.
Thank you, Larry. This has been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it. To professor at Indiana University, the social psychologist also affiliated with Stanford University. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's NPR's Here and Now, then Fresh Air with Terry Gross, hosting at noon today, followed by NPR's All Things Considered at 1 o'clock. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9, right after Morning Edition, for Air Talk, Southern California's biggest conversation. Have a great day.
The stakes to save the Colorado River are high.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
California and six other states on the river must reach a compromise, but they're divided. The fate of the river may come down to a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
The people and the real human drama behind the historic negotiations. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.